back to That's Ancient History. I'm your host, Dr. Jean Mingus, and today I am joined by the incredible Erica Stevenson, who's a classical civilizations graduate from NYU. I was about to say NYU University, but that is implicit in the U. Erica is also the founder, host, and producer of the online project Mon Inc., aka Modern Ancients Inc., which is a YouTube channel and social media based project which champions classics in the modern era, brings classics to a modern audience. And if you haven't yet watched any of Erica's incredible videos yet, the kind of things that you'll find if you head over there are breakdowns of classical texts, summaries, analysis, interviews with some really interesting people, scholars and authors alike, and book reviews of classical texts and discussions with other like nerds like ourselves.
It's a little place where we can all come together.
Yay! All classics nerds welcome at any level. That's what's important. So naturally, Erica seemed like the perfect person to kick off the new season of That's Ancient History with, talking about accessibility and classics in the modern world in general, because that's something that we are both incredibly passionate about. And in fact, Erica interviewed me last year for her channel, which was such a fun experience. It reminded me actually in part how much I love like kind of the podcast interview style content and how fun it is to just sit down in conversation with everybody. So I'm really excited to pick your brain this time.
We could swap exactly a year later.
I could ask you the same questions, probably some of them at least. Just written
Oh
them
my
down.
God, we should have done that. That would be so cute.
Some sort of weird inception.
It's like those videos. Have you seen like that bit? Totally not on classics topic, but Billie Eilish does like the same interview every year. And they
No.
ask her, oh, stop, I'll send it to you after this.
Okay.
And so she answers the same questions and they change every year. And like, it's things like, who's the most famous person in your phone or whatever. We could have had one of those moments, Jean.
Yes. Oh my God, an annual sort of like catch up update, how it changes over the years. What's your favorite classical myth this year?
It changed? Why?
Do you hate somebody new from classical myth? Have you discovered a new classical myth retelling? Would be an easy one because there's always new ones coming out.
That's true.
That's true. But I'm asking you the questions, so if you don't mind.
I'll stop. My bad. I'm already off camera. I'd already said, like, make sure you stop me from being the interviewer. And here we are, like 5 minutes in.
It's okay, it's okay. If it descends, we'll get it back. We'll get it back. My natural instinct whenever I talk to anybody, whether they're like a myth retelling author, a scholar, an enthusiast, what have you, is to start off by asking how you got into classics and the study of ancient history. That is where my curiosity begins, and I'd like to hear about the beginning of your journey.
I love context questions. Oh my God, I ask everybody these questions too. So mine is kind of by accident. So I went to a private school and you had to take Latin at school. And I hated it. I thought it was like the biggest waste of time. I was like, what am I doing? And I used to read books under the table during class. My poor teacher would come over and like confiscate Twilight or The Hunger Games, like whatever it was I was reading. And finally, I started reading Percy Jackson. And my teacher confiscated, I mean, must have been book four or book five at this point. And I go up to get my book at the end of class, and he's like, I noticed that these books that you're reading, they're about Greek mythology. Why don't you try this other class? It's more so along this line. And I was like, oh, I'm not really interested. And he said, it gets you out of Latin. So I was like, sign me up. Like, wherever it is, sign me up. I don't care if I have to switch buildings, whatever it is. And I went to classics and I stayed and stayed forever, apparently.
I love that. What is I have you ever spoken to that teacher since? Because what an impact.
I did. So I then, when I went to NYU for classics, I mean, everybody was shocked because they were also like, you have to take Latin again, right? Like, you can't avoid this subject forever. And I was like, no, it's fine. Now I'm excited about it.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I came back after and I sat down with him and my other classics teacher to talk about some idea at the time. And they were like, it's so wild that you're here talking to us about classics. Like, what has happened? I was like, I know. Isn't this funny?
So you never write off anybody. You don't know when you'll get into something, what and how it will take you.
Yeah, and what that trigger will be. You have
Yeah,
no
exactly.
idea.
Being saved from Latin is the best trigger I can think of. As somebody who hated doing Latin and is very much an ancient Greek girl, I can sympathize.
Like the language, though, as well.
No, All I remember, and you'll know this exactly as well, is just where you're like, Canis est in via. That's it. It's just all of the Cambridge introductory Latin texts where they're all in Pompeii, and you're like, the chef is in the kitchen.
Caecilius est in horto.
Exactly. That's it. I love that, like, anybody who's ever studied Latin has that shared moment.
Like these odd phrases that just everyone knows. It's like it's not going to help you at all in later
Yeah.
Latin, but I guess it helped at the time.
Yeah. Better than nothing. Well, in that case, obviously, like you said, it was a bit of a surprise to everybody that you ended up doing classics. But like with any degree, someone can go to university and discover this is not actually for me, which is not what happened with you. I'm assuming you fell completely head over heels with the subject. So are there any moments from your studies that really stand out to you as like moments where you felt, oh, this is a part of my life forever now?
Oh, definitely. Especially at university, I did a semester abroad in Athens. And I think up until that point, like I just really liked reading the stories. And then when I started doing Latin, I started kind of understanding, oh, I can read these stories in the real, like original language. And to have that sort of connection in your head where you're like, whoa. But certainly, I think I realized I was stuck in classics when I went to Athens and being in all the sites, and we were kind of bussed around to all of these random sites to help with digs or just like help for the day. And I was not a digging kind of gal,
Nope.
but being there was, it's just so magical to actually see those places and to place these stories amongst the rocks or the views, you know, all of those little moments. And I was just, I mean, just done. That was it.
No going back. Struck.
Definitely. And especially, I mean, just Greece is magical in general. Like everyone who's ever been to an island, regardless of seeing ancient sites, it's just a breathtaking country. I was like, just adopt me. Can I just be Greek?
Have you spent much time in Greece since your year abroad in Athens?
I did. So what year is it? No, it's 2024 now. So 2 years ago, I spent a month in Athens just because I could like work remotely. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to go in the off season. And it was like right before tourist season, and it was so peaceful and quiet. Oh, I could have stayed there forever. I could always stay there forever.
The last time I went to Athens actually was February, and I just found it like the perfect time to be there because it wasn't actually, compared to Scotland anyway, it didn't actually feel that cold, but nothing was as busy as you expect it to be. It was really easy to wander around and see things and not get stuck in queues and feel the kind of power of it all, which was quite nice.
Absolutely. And I feel like as well during, and this is with any country, but like during tourist season, prices are so crazy. And like people are always trying to poach you to buy something or do some sort of tour or whatever. And whenever you go off season, everyone's just mellow. They're just happy that you're there. They just want to hang out. And especially Greek people are some of the most friendly people you'll ever meet. And it was just, oh, amazing.
Now I want to go book a holiday. Was there anything in that case whilst you were studying that surprised you, whether it was about like the classics discipline or just factually about antiquity at all?
No, I would say when it was like me being abroad in Greece, it was more so I surprised myself with how much that I was learning. I think because I always really struggled academically to like perform on tests and to kind of memorize things. And I'd always viewed academics as memorizing and producing, and I just couldn't do that. And in Greece, because we were around everything and I felt like I was just kind of absorbing everything absentmindedly, that then when it came to discussion time or lectures or whatever it was, I felt like I was up to pace with everybody, and I was like, who is she? Who is this woman sitting here that suddenly understands everything and is pulling Latin and Greek and all of this out of my head? So that I would say was the biggest surprise, definitely.
I love that. I love that. It's a journey of personal discovery through ancient history. How fabulous!
Ancient history and Greece, like just Greece as a place in general. Ugh.
It's funny actually. I have to agree. I hate exams. I think exams should be banned. I think that is not a good way to test people in the slightest. What they can like remember off the top of their head, rather than being able to refer to things in like a stressful hour. I hate it.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And you know, one of the moments when I was at school, not at university, but that I really loved classics, but I was like, oh, I'm never going to be able to do this on the exam, was when I was 16, and I'm very open about this, by the way. But when I was 16, I went to rehab and I was alone for like 2.5 weeks on the ward.
A
It was
lot.
just like a time where apparently nobody else was struggling, just me. So I was so bored. And I was like begging my mum to go and get me anything from school. And obviously the school was like, we are not giving her work. This is not the time. There's no way we're giving her homework. And I was like, please. And finally my classics teacher gave my mum a copy of The Odyssey and was like, just tell her to read this. And I read it and I plowed through it. And I loved it. I was like, what an amazing story. And then she slowly started sending off these questions to me to be like, okay, we'll start thinking about these then. If you want to go back in, lost on me. I was like, the story was so good, but these questions are so weird. And they're asking me for such peculiar things that even though I know this book, I couldn't translate it to the test and to the answers. I mean, I did fine. I don't want anyone listening to this thinking I failed everything or whatever. I just wasn't getting like full marks, which I felt like I could though, because I knew that I knew it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you need to know the questions in advance so that you can be looking for this whilst you're reading it.
100%. Yeah. It's all about like, can you get these odd 5 marks and they're in the mark scheme? And you mentioned one thing that wasn't on the mark scheme, but it's technically right, but still it's wrong.
Irrelevant to your score.
Yep. Great. 100%.
To this day, I am still furious at my master's course when at this point we're long past me doing any Latin and I'm doing my ancient Greek exams during my master's, and we weren't allowed dictionaries in the exams, but all of my friends that were doing Latin were allowed dictionaries in the exam. And I was like, excuse me, what?
The betrayal.
Right? It's just like, this is very unfair. So is there a moment, was it during your studies or after you left, perhaps when you felt like you were looking for another way to explore classics, where the idea of Monink or modern ancients really like formulated itself in your brain?
I love that you keep saying modern ancients, because no one like pays attention to that. That's what Monink stands for.
And there's purpose.
I feel like it's everywhere. I post it everywhere all the time. And people will be like, Moan's a really weird name. And I'm like, look at the banner. The banner says modern ancients. I just couldn't use that because someone else already used that. Like,
and Monink is short and catchy, but it has meaning. I like it.
That's what I thought. But it literally goes over so many people's heads. And I'm like, it's okay. I'm going to have to try and make it even. Like, now I've re-edited everything so that they're different colors as well. I'm like, maybe that'll help. If like M-O and A-N are into, we'll see. I'll update you in a few months.
And the A is capital, is it not, as well? So
now it is.
Yeah. That's got to do it.
We hope. Again, I'll be sending you a message update in a few months to see how it rolls over. But actually, so Moan kind of came to me in two different ways. It came to me first when I was in rehab and I was loving The Odyssey and I was like loving all of these things. And I had so much time to think. Like, people don't realize like you have so much structure in those environments. Like, you have to do so many therapies or so many hours of school and whatever it is. And then you have weekends to do nothing. And you're not allowed to go outside and you're not allowed to have people over whenever you want to. You've got 2 hours in the evening where people can come see you. So the rest of the time you're like watching films or staring at walls and you're just bored. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be so cool to create like a production company that only retells ancient stories and does it in like loads of different ways? And so I kind of had like that idea. It wasn't called Moan, it wasn't a YouTube channel, it was just like some crazy thing that I started thinking of, and then it went dormant. And then I graduated university and I started working at a pub in London, very long story short. And when I was there, I started like accidentally yapping all of my regulars' ears off about ancient history, and they were like, you have to do this somewhere else, like this is not the place for you to do this. And so that's when I thought of, okay, well, maybe I should do it on social media. Maybe YouTube would be best because it's long form and I tend to ramble about things quite a bit. And so then it became Moan. So it was those two sort of little things where it was kind of already in there. And I was like, I guess I should just do it so that these poor people keep buying drinks and they don't leave.
It was just another rescue mission, just like being sent out of Latin.
Oh yeah, that's literally the story of my life, Jean. Like, you got it.
I love it. Well, it has come to beautiful fruition, I think. Something wonderful has come from the unappreciative pub customers.
And they are like the sweetest. I want to say this now in case they're listening. Like, They were the first people that supported me. Like when I was first posting my videos, they were so excited. They were like, oh my God, you posted on YouTube. I'm going to share it with my friends and all of this. And like they would come in with their other friends or their other colleagues and they'd be like, she's famous on YouTube. That was when I had like one subscriber, you know? So they were always amazing and so supportive. But yeah, they were definitely sick of me talking about it behind the bar.
I love
Absolutely.
that though. That is so lovely. Well, it just goes to show how much everybody can enjoy ancient history and classical mythology.
Look at that. What a nice conclusion. I was like, oh God, they don't want me to talk to them anymore.
Maybe that's the end of the podcast now, you know. We've summed it
Yeah,
up.
that's it.
Classics is
Yep,
great.
done.
Done. Well, if your goal then is to make antiquity modern, to make it accessible to modern audiences, what this is probably a little bit unfair, but like, what is your top sort of recommendation for people who are looking to get into classics and ancient mystery? Well, the mysteries of antiquity, ancient history or myth. I was just smooshing those things together because that makes mystery. What do you recommend more often than not, really, to people who are looking to get into this subject?
Like, as in somebody who's a reader or somebody who's, because I think that everybody's so different. And so if people always want to get into
Okay.
it, I always start off by saying, okay, well, like, what do you like? Like, are you a reader? Are you somebody that watches TV a lot? Like, are you somebody that goes, that likes to be outside? You know, people who are like really busy all the time, like my boyfriend's like this, he cannot sit still. So I have different recommendations for all of them.
But that sounds like even better than what I asked. That sounds so much better and so much well more well formulated that you've like got sort of different routes for different people. So, okay, I'm gonna imagine some different people then. Say I am somebody who's read Circe and Girl, Goddess, Queen and started to read a few retellings and really enjoyed them, but mainly because I came from like enjoying fantasy and romance books. Where do I go now?
Oh, well, I would say Stephen Fry's Mythos would be the next one because I think that's that next step to, you know, all of those are fiction and they're really fun and they're wacky. I mean, I love Girl, Goddess, Queen. I am such a promoter of that book. I thought it was so fun. But for people who really are coming into it from that myth perspective, but that want to kind of slowly move that upwards and kind of get to the ancient texts, I always say Stephen Fry's Mythos because I think that's a really accurate retelling while still being really fun and lighthearted, and jokes are thrown in there, and it's very close to Ovid. So once you get that, you can then jump to Ovid very quickly. And so that's kind of the direction I would tell those people to go in.
And what about somebody who has been watching the new Percy Jackson Disney adaptation?
Here's a fun fact. I still haven't watched
Neither have
that.
I. It's okay. I will, but I haven't.
But definitely from there, like, I would, I mean, I, for those people, I tend to list off a bunch of different things. If they haven't watched Disney's Hercules, like those things, because it's clearly that they just love the fantasy element of the mythology. And so it's okay, what else draws in a lot of fantasy that is also kind of accurate? So get them on that realm of Disney's Hercules, maybe then upgrade them a little bit to Gladiator, which is my all-time favorite if they are of age.
I've never seen Gladiator.
Jean, we're gonna have problems. What?
Everybody reacts that way, and I don't know. It's not been an intentional refuse to watch. It's just never happened.
Oh my God, I'm coming up there just so that we can watch Gladiator, and then I swear I'll just come back home. It
It's
is
fine.
life-changing. I watch it at least once a year. I sob the whole way, not because it's sad. There's only one sad moment, and I never cry at that moment. I sob because of how inspirational it is.
That's
Like, literally, I watch it and I'm like, oh my God, the Spaniard, look at all he's been through. It's ridiculous.
as long as it's better than 300, because I hate that film.
And you have every right to. See, that's the thing, you know, the more experts that I've spoken to when it comes to film, the more of them are like, we got to stop hating on like Troy and 300. And I'm an advocate for hating on both of those. Like, I am behind any hate of those films. And they're like, we have to stop because it's free advertising for our subject. And now I'm like, you know what? I kind of see that.
I don't mind Troy actually, for all that it's completely, I mean, it's completely inaccurate, Don't get me wrong, it's absurd, but it's an entertaining film.
My heart is hurting.
Whereas like 300, I thought was like the most simultaneously violent and boring thing I'd ever seen in one sitting, and I was like, how have you done that?
See, the thing with 300, like 300 is just whatever. Like I think I've only watched it twice because I watched it once and I was like, not for me. And then I watched it again and I was like, historically also not for me. Like just neither of these things I enjoy. And then I watched Troy and I just didn't, I actually felt offended by Troy. And I think it's because I love the Iliad so much. Like it is my pride and my joy. And I will defend little decisions in the Iliad. Like people will try and debate me, and I'm like, no. And here's
Perfect.
why. Literally, I'm like, it links to this one line in book 13. Don't you dare talk about that. Like, oh. So with Troy, no, I just can't. And when I hear people being like, oh no, we can't be mean about Troy because so many people have wanted to get into the Trojan War because of it, it's like a big sigh. And I'm like, maybe, but also, why?
I think you're allowed to have two spaces in your mind as somebody who has like an academic connection to a subject, and one is like the academic removal of I appreciate anything that gets people into subject, and the other is like your personal vehement hatred of something because it's just not what you wanted, and those are okay and they can coexist.
It's like anybody reacting to Disney's Hercules. It's like this is horribly inaccurate, and yet it's the best thing that has ever been made.
Best soundtrack ever to have been soundtracked.
Like honestly, I think I have the little cassette still of Hercules.
Okay, well then I have to ask as well if you have some highlights from Mon Inc, like on a personal and perhaps like more like career level, but just like moments in what has now been a few years, right, recording Mon Inc, where they just really stand out to you and they've been quite special.
Definitely, I think my all-time favorite moment has been interviewing Gregory Nagy, who, for people who are listening who don't know who that is, he is one of the top dogs in classics. He's a professor at Harvard. He's literally in his late 70s, and he wrote this incredible book, which is called The Ancient Greek Hero in 24 Hours. So he's not like a big public historian at all, but he wrote this book that I just like was obsessed with. And I had watched all of his lectures and just everything. Like I had signed up for his online course and I just emailed him and was like, do you want to talk to me about all this? And he replied and he was so kind and he was like, I would love to. And we sat down and we spoke for like a total of 2.5 hours, I think. And I just got to rack his brain about, because he's really a linguistics guy, and so he comes at classics and through epic poetry through this like linguistic lens. So interesting. I cut out most of it because it was so niche, but like it was definitely still, I look back and I'm like, I can't believe I was lucky enough to have that one-on-one time with someone as kind and as open and so willing to share that information with me and subsequently my audience. Definitely Gregory Nagy.
That is wonderful. I do love those kind of like really special moments where you meet someone that's like had an impact on you as well. And the passion then shines through, I think, in like the interviews as well. And the person appreciates it, I'm sure.
Oh, 100%. I was like sobbing internally, not external. Externally, I was very cool, guys, but internally, I was like, oh my God, what's happening?
I love that when you have to suddenly like put professional hat on and inside you're like, if I was like 18 right now and knew what was happening, I'd be having a breakdown in the best possible way.
Literally, the whole day before, I was so nervous and I was like, oh God, I have to memorize all of my questions and make sure that they sound natural. Ended up using none of those questions. We were just talking the whole time. But still, it's like I still look at that video on my channel and I'm like, look at it. It's so pretty.
Oh, I love that. Is there somewhere in particular you'd like to see Mon Inc go next? Do you have like any goals for the future?
Oh my God, I have so many goals. I think the next step that I really want to do, which is something that I'm going to be like talking to my audience about anyways, is that I want to be creating playlists. So, if people who don't know what Mon Inc is at the moment, just in case, because this is not going to make any sense otherwise, I do a lot of summaries to kind of get people to read the ancient texts. So, a lot of those summaries include lots of detail, and then I'll miss out really important chunks and I'll say, go read this. you know, and things like that to try and get people back to the book. Otherwise, they're never going to read it. And those are like my most popular videos. So I have the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid. I just did the Argonautica and the plays of Aeschylus. So next, I'm going to be doing Herodotus as a summary. But what I would love to do is create playlists that sort of have all of these context videos included in it. So any outside mythology to the book is all in that playlist. And conversations with experts, who I have a couple on the back burner right now, to come in to do, you know, more so talks of like the intricacies of those texts. So like armor in the Iliad, like what are we expecting? Or like what does a battlefield look like in this epic poem? Or what is sea travel like at the time that Odysseus would be going? Like, what sort of ancient context do we have and those things? So that's the next step, is like more so creating these bigger playlists so that people can read the book and then get that extra context at the same time.
Oh, I really like that. I really like that. I actually have a friend who I interviewed previously on this podcast, harking back to a previous episode, who is just finishing up their PhD on post-traumatic stress disorder and parallels in ancient texts for like PTSD in terms of texts, obviously, that involve a lot of fighting, like the Iliad.
Send me their details.
I will.
That will be an interesting interview, because like I have some people lined up for the armor. I have one lined up for the sea travel, which is why I mentioned both of those. And I have a couple sort of like on that realm. And I would love to get more people who do translations as well, to say like, you know, what are things that we're missing, just for like entry level. It's just if people are reading in their own time and they want to know those extra things, but they don't have, you know, the extra £20 at the end of the month to go and listen for 1 hour to a lecture that's happening, because they're expensive. Not only are they expensive, but then there's also travel to and from, and there's all of this stuff that's involved in it. So it's like, well, if I can get those things and sort of encompass them on the channel for free, that somebody can save in their watch later and whenever they can, just, okay, well, I didn't get this aspect of, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder aspect of the Iliad. Like, what is Achilles going through? Well, then we have somebody doing that so that you can do that and learn that and engage with that in your own time and at your own pace. I think that's so key. Like I always found at school, especially at university, things went way too fast. Like at the end of the lecture, I would be like, I have no idea what we discussed, because I was just taking notes and nothing went in. And then next week we're moving eras, but I'm not even sure what happened in this era. And so I love the idea that on YouTube and creating content like yours as well, you know, podcasts and whatnot, you can just pause something. You can watch and you can get lost and you can pause, rewind, re-listen, Google, listen to somebody else's video. Like it's all at your own pace. And that's my favorite thing.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one of the things actually, when you were describing how you'd like the playlists to look, that really stood out to me is the fact that you'd be sort of dipping into different areas of something. So I'm going to stick with the Iliad and say armor or the sea. It kind of shows how broad these subjects can be and how many different interests they can encompass. So if somebody has an interest in historical armor, they might find the Iliad interesting. If somebody has an interest in sea warfare, they might find it interesting. There's like lots of different routes into everything.
So absolutely, the points of entry are so important. And I think that like it's such a disservice that we do like as classicists, and I've noticed that because I do it as well, and I have no doubt that you've done it once or twice, but like the way that we categorize like all of these books, you know, will be like, that's the war book, that's the monster book, or that's this book, or whatever it is. And really there's so much in every book that everyone can, you know, get stuck into. Like even with the Iliad, I tell people like there's such interesting female characters in the Iliad. No, it's not a female, you know, driven plot, but there are some like Andromache is such a phenomenal character to get into, of what she does and how she reacts and her purpose of being in Troy and being that like wonderful wife to Hector and what that means. And like, you know, there are different points of entry that's so important to highlight, because in every text, someone can find something.
Actually, and when you say that, it does make me think as well about obviously the modern popularity, particularly recently, not that it's never happened before, of retellings of Greek mythology. And there's been a few, say, around like the Trojan War and the events in the Iliad and things like The Trojan Women, from like Pat Barker to Natalie Haynes. And people love these books, right? They love that we get a female perspective, and we love that we get to hear from these women. But those authors couldn't have written these phenomenal works if there wasn't like the seeds of these women and their experiences and their ideas in the original texts as well.
100%. And I think that that's something that got lost over time, you know, and obviously that's due to, you know, different structures of society in different countries and elitism and all of that. But that's such a key point that you bring up there, like, especially with the feminist retellings, no one's making up this story.
Yeah.
Like, these aren't new stories. They are the stories. It's just for some reason, somebody was like, actually, we're not going to tell those ones anymore. Or we're going to change them, which is wild. So no, I completely agree.
Yeah, it's actually funny because one of the things that I wrote about recently when I was talking about queer myth retellings was the fact that there's a more recent book, I don't know if you've read it yet, but it's really good, called Herc, which is a retelling of Heracles' story. And one of the things that comes throughout that story is that Herc is queer. Herc has relationships with men and women. Yet somehow, sort of in the 20th century, and maybe even before then, Herc became a very, very straight, macho, straight man. And the queer side of him, which is actually part of his ancient personality because he has sex with men and women in ancient myth, disappeared. And I think the same thing can happen sort of like, you know, when academia is dominated by men, women get overlooked, but it doesn't mean they weren't there. And it's sort of something that maybe did exist, got swept under the carpet.
Yeah, and that's all it is though. Like, that literally being swept under the carpet. It's just, oh, we're going to, because it's not my interest.
Yes.
We're going to get rid of it. And then when people find it, they're like, whoa, did you know that this? Yes, we all knew. The ancients knew. We had these wonderful, powerful characters. Like, you know, think of a Clytemnestra or a Medea. Like, these are terrifying characters. Like, they're characters that women and men should read and go, don't know if I want to be in the same room as them, just in case I blink at them wrong. Like, that's who they are. And that's brilliant. Like, that's so incredible that we have women who are written that strongly and are allowed to be villains. That's the key, right? That they are given that platform to be a villain, but also morally gray. And like, to have all of those characters exist, and yet for some reason, like with Herc, they kind of get like just sort of pigeonholed into one idea. Like, here's the one line, because that's what we're comfortable with. Here's the character pitch. Well,
yeah, and it doesn't always match up, especially given that there's so many versions of myths. Sometimes someone can seem pretty inconsistent. And that hurts our brains, I think. So we start trying to like make them this like sort of straight, literally and metaphorically, just kind of like version of themselves.
Yeah, I think that that's a very like modern idea, you know, this idea to kind of like pigeonhole things into one category that makes us comfortable. You know, and like, we see this mostly like now with like women pushing through saying, you know, why can't I be beautiful and smart? Or why can't I be a mum and a CEO? You know, all of those things, because it is such a modern idea that you can't be both. But it did, like, that doesn't exist in the ancient world. Like, people could be so many different versions of themselves, and they can change with different people and different storylines. Like, Medea is a great one. Like, she's great in Colchis. She's like the ideal daughter in Colchis. She's like this priestess of Hecate. She's doing her things. They're like, oh, amazing. And then she turns around. She goes, actually, never mind. I'm going to go off with him. And you're like, oh, okay. You go and do that. And then Jason's like, I love you. And then he turns around. He says, actually, I lied. There's a lot going on, you know? But this idea that people can change and they can grow or they can regress.
Yeah.
Like, all of that is so, I think, is such an important thing from the ancient sources that people like forget.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point, and something I think I might have to mention more to people is that idea, I think, that like a mythological character isn't just a character that is stationary or in stasis. They're somebody who can grow and change like any human being throughout their story.
Absolutely. And especially like with, I mean, I'm just picking on these like very strong women because I just love looking at them. Like, who wouldn't? Because they're so interesting. But we see them at so many different moments of their life and so many different moments of their journey. Mm-hmm. And like, Clytemnestra is my favorite because she starts off as being like this incredibly powerful woman, like just an incredible queen, like who's given all this power And then Agamemnon screws up, and she just has this slow descent into, I'm not gonna lie, giving a lot of Agamemnon energy by the end of it. Like, there are scenes of her, like, in the Eumenides, where she says verbatim what Agamemnon says in the underworld in the Odyssey. And you're like, how did that happen? Like, you've ended up hating him so much that you've kind of become him in a
Love
very
that.
strange way. But it's so interesting. It's so interesting to follow that route. And I know that that's going to make a lot of people listening to this like, no, we hate Agamemnon, we love Clytemnestra. Absolutely. I'm on board with you. There are just some interesting notes about how people change and what that means for people.
I mean, Clytemnestra for me, just like on a personal perspective, could have been absolute queen, get your revenge, go girl, if she'd only killed Agamemnon and not also killed Cassandra. Like that's the moment where she loses me. Because otherwise I'd be like, yeah, avenge Iphigenia, do it.
Absolutely. I think she's just such a fascinating character. Like, I think just as a whole, like when you read all of her different little moments, and especially like, I mean, I mentioned the Eumenides one because I read it most recently. Like, when she comes up, people who don't know, the Eumenides is the third play in the Oresteia, the only trilogy that we have from the ancient world. And in the Oresteia, we see Agamemnon come home, he gets murdered in the tub. Hopefully everyone knows that. Otherwise, this would be really awkward. Yeah, really sorry. 2,000-year-old spoilers here. But in the last play, Clytemnestra is now dead, and she goes to see the Furies who have been put to sleep by Apollo. And she literally has this moment where she's like, oh, isn't it so nice that my son, Orestes, who just murdered me, has such good friends that he can walk around and he can be protected? Not like me, because you guys are asleep. And you're like, what?
The sass.
It's so good. It's obviously a tragedy and it's not supposed to be funny. And I cackled when I read it. I was like, this is incredible writing from Aeschylus.
It's a good reminder as well that some of the things people say in ancient texts, although they were maybe written in ancient languages, and when they're translated into English, they don't feel that modern, kind of do strike a modern tone.
Oh, so much of it. I mean, especially because I do a lot of content which, like, you know, pulls it down from, you know, the ancient Greek or whatever. And I check it to make sure I'm getting it kind of right. But for the most part, I'm like, what is he basically saying? Well, he's basically telling someone to go away. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do in the video, which is, oh, you've come all this way, leave. Like, that's it. Long scene short. There was a long summary of the entire book in there. There was a great metaphor, some lovely similes, and we're getting rid of all of that so that you guys know he's just telling this guy to go away.
That's what you need sometimes. You really just need to get to the point. Well, we've been talking a lot about what you help teach people out there, spreading knowledge, making things accessible. But I think even when we're trying to teach other people things, we often learn things ourselves. So I'm curious, what have you learned from the project?
Oh my God, where do I even start? I have learned so much from doing Moan. And a lot of it has been communication. You know, I think that when I started, I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but like I thought, and I think because I had been so engaged with classics for so long, I assumed that everybody had a much higher base level than they did, which I realized I'm the weird one. Like I'm the one that got into it very young and kind of had it there the whole time. And so when I started making videos, and these videos now don't exist because they just didn't work, you know, I would be talking about things, but from a different perspective. And it was from a vantage point that other people couldn't meet me at because they didn't have that base level in there of like, when is this set? What's happening in the background? Like, what time period? Things that I took for granted that I always knew. And the main thing that I learned was there's absolutely nothing wrong from starting from the ground up. To make sure that everybody's with you when you start talking about the important thing.
I love that. That is probably the best takeaway anybody could ever have, as far as I'm
It's
concerned.
like, just check yourself, basically. Like, just make sure that you know, like, okay, well, maybe I know this thing, but it's okay that other people don't. Like, that's the normal thing. And no one should feel, and that was the key. Like, I realized that inadvertently a lot of my videos were making people feel, not feel bad, but just kind of feel like they weren't in the know. And so they didn't want to tune in because they were like, oh, it's kind of coming across that she feels like she knows more than us, which was not the case. But then it just, you know, it forced me to really readjust, okay, how do we do this and how do we get people on board and get people strapped in and ready for the roller coaster?
And nobody knows anything until they know it. Like, it's literally as simple
Exactly.
as that.
Exactly. And I think, like, as well, for example, I know nothing about Norse mythology and I never know where to start. Like, I see a video on Norse mythology and I'm like, I don't know if I can click on that because I don't know anything. Like, I know a couple of gods' names and that's it. And I don't know what they do or anything. And so I always have to think, like, okay, other people are coming into this the way that I view Norse mythology. And as long as I keep that in mind, then it's okay.
You should check out Matt Ralph's book on Norse mythology, which is it's a children's book. So you know that I've written children's books for DK in their myth series. There's a Norse book in that series too, which is written by somebody else called Matt Ralph's, and it's illustrated by Katie Ponder. And it is such a good overview of Norse mythology, and it's beautifully illustrated and accessible and still really enjoyable if you're an adult.
I will definitely have to check that out. It's
Really
like
good.
that's like the next one that I really want to tackle.
Yeah.
But like, okay, I don't know anything about that. I think that's the funny thing. Like, I don't know if you have this, but when I tell people, like, oh yeah, I study and I look at the ancient world, and now I kind of present it on YouTube, I guess, and I mention the ancient world without getting specific, people have like these ideas that either you know everything or you study cavemen. It's like one or the other. Like I never have people hit it right. And I'm like, whoa, I've no idea what you're asking me about.
Yeah, and like when you study something, you do often, you can get maybe a broad understanding of things, but you'll always get niche on something. You'll
Oh
always
yeah.
end up in a niche space and not know other things. Like when I've been like at universities and in academia and stuff and talked to other colleagues, and we're both technically in the same discipline and we know completely different things.
100%. And I love it. That's the thing about niches. When I like ask people about their niches, I get so interested because I'm like, I've never heard any of this. Like, actually, we're operating in the same time period. And yet you're over there in the corner holding something weird. And I'm like, what is that? And yet they don't know anything that I'm talking about either. So it's like this really cool thing. We get to like pick somebody's brain and they just know so much about this one thing. And you're like, whoa, just keep talking. Like,
And it's funny because it's not how you start off at university. You start off doing things quite broadly. And one of the most bizarre experiences I ever had was when I was teaching, lecturing first year undergraduates, as a PhD student, because suddenly I had to like really pull it back, like you're saying before. You have to learn sort of where you're starting from and try and figure out what's the baseline here. Obviously, someone's picked this degree, but that doesn't necessarily mean they know loads about it. And also realize that because I've gone so far in one direction, it's been years since I've looked at this, and I need to go back and refresh my memory.
that's been me with so many texts. I realized the only one I consistently read was the Iliad. And then I was like, well, I have to do other things on the channel because people can't just read and reread and read and reread the Iliad like me. That's really boring for most people. Not for me. Every time I go in, I'm like, did you know that this shield was made out of this kind of material? And no one else cares, which is fine. But I was like, okay, I've got to go and read these other things. I hadn't read the Odyssey since I was like, no. Maybe 18, because I had to read it again at university. And I just forgot so much funny stuff in it. And when I was rereading it, I was like, this is a brilliant, but like, this is great.
Yep. I actually now really want to suggest you come back on the podcast and we just talk about the Iliad, and I can just ask you those questions about the Iliad.
I will absolutely do that. Like, anytime I get to be like, here's this really random reference, and here's this really funny joke that no one cares about, but I do. 100%. I'm so down.
Okay. Maybe I can learn to love the Iliad a little bit more than I do currently.
See, it just breaks my heart. I think the thing with the Iliad is that we say it's the war book, and so people go into it being like, okay, it's the war book, and there are these long passages of war. Yes. But around that is such a great story. And like the war parts, then when you realize it's a really small part of it. It's just to kind of get you that feel of the battlefield and the deaths and the all of this, to create that atmosphere of like, there's loss everywhere. Like, this is a really tragic environment, but it's not the story. And when you kind of start isolating the story, like some people say on my videos, like, what Homer are you reading? Like, where is this? I'm like, it's in the book. I swear, you're just getting distracted by the 4-page long description of this guy being a lion on the battlefield and stalking his prey. But that's, you just move on. Just ignore it. Just keep going.
Get that list of ships.
Yeah, I'm like, just go for it. I have to say, I love the list of ships because I love number crunching. This is so bad. I don't like reading it. Like, as a story, it's really like jolting to get to a catalogue. But once you actually get into it and you're like, hey, this person had 80 ships, and they tell you like, oh, there should be this many people on each boat. So you're like, interesting. And so then you start kind of doing the numbers and you're like, okay, so this is how many people should have been there at the start. And then later on, you get like another part where you find out how many Trojans there are because they make a little reference. Then you start like number crunching, you have like these whole documents of numbers. And I, bear in mind everybody who's listening, was horrible at maths at school. The worst, to the point where my maths teacher was like, you cannot do this subject past this point. Like, this is horrendous. And yet, here we are, me with the catalogue of ships being like, I wonder how many men actually went.
They just needed to teach it through the lens of classics.
Honestly, it would have all gone in. I would have been like, how many apples does Kevin have? Well, if they were shields, this is how many.
I completely agree though. I think some things suddenly become 100 times more interesting as soon as you start analysing it.
I think that when you, especially when it's something that you're interested in and you realise how many different ways something can be read, or how this thing impacts this other thing if it's read in a certain way, or, you know, in that boring example that I used, number crunching, like if there are numbers, like now we're at this point in all of this, it starts to create this big picture when you analyze things of like why this is going on and why this is important, and where you can then take that and be like, oh, a similar message was written about here. So what does that say about the people that are writing this stuff and the society and all of this nerdy rubbish, I guess.
No such thing as nerdy rubbish.
Only I say that all the time on my channel.
Wonder. I don't know, what's the opposite of rubbish? Nerdy treasure. Nerdy treasure.
Nerdy treasure. That's so cute. Stop.
Well, I have to say, I feel like if anybody has come into this episode not quite yet a classics enthusiast, they will be now.
They have to be. I'm forcing them to be, actually. In my series, I always force people, like, I'm like, stop watching this video. I need you to go and put on this color shirt because this is how we feel today. Like Patrick Lestais, I was like, no one is watching this without a black shirt on. I wore black shirt for the next like 4 videos. I was like, don't care. This is what we're doing. And then if some, like, literally reading about Cersei, I'm like, go get yourself a drink. Stop the video. Go get yourself a drink. Like, I'm forcing you all to be engaged nerds. That's how this is working.
Half pay attention to me.
Pause the video. I don't care if this impacts the analytics or anything. This is how we're doing this lesson.
That's such a lovely approach. And I have to just say, Moan Ink is just a wonderful, incredible project. And I would highly recommend anybody listening or watching this to go check it out, especially if you're sick of the inconsistency of That's Ancient History and need a massive backlog of phenomenal classics content. It's over there.
And an episode with Jean, of course.
If you'd like,
we did highlight all of your great work last year. I was like, tell us all about it.
You want to see me in the hot seat? Well, I do actually ask the exact same question at the end of every single episode of everybody that's ever come on That's Ancient History, and I'm keeping it up today, which is, could you recommend us a book? And it doesn't have to be a book relevant to anything we've talked about. It can be an ancient history book, it can be a classical text, it can be a myth retelling, it could have literally nothing to do with ancient history and you just want to talk about it.
Okay, so mine is a myth retelling, but it's one that I feel like doesn't get enough credit and enough attention at all. It's called Savage Beasts by Rani Selvaraja. It's a retelling of Jason and Medea, but set in colonial India.
Ooh.
It is so phenomenal because it obviously has to retake this myth, but it changes it cross-culturally. And like, it's, she just did it so brilliantly. Like, I had Rani on to talk about it on my channel and everybody was like, I'd never heard of this book. I haven't seen it since. Like, you go to any bookshop and it's always like hidden in a corner. And I'm like, what is happening? Like, this is so incredible. So definitely if you're looking for something new, if you're looking for something that is historical fiction and kind of Greek myth, because the characters change names. So it's James and Mina instead of Jason and Medea. Then definitely read Rani's book. Like, she is just a phenomenal writer.
But I also love books like that because there's no requirement for classical knowledge going into it.
100%. And I learned so much from it as well. Like, I didn't know really anything about this sounds really bad growing up in the UK, but like I didn't really know anything about colonial India. Like I didn't really know anything about that time. And so even when I spoke to her, I was like, I want to ask you about all of this part of the history that you know and that you wanted to write into your book and write the impacts of it and what happens and all of this. So there's so many layers to that book where you can, you know, I went into it with the Greek myth, but you can just go into it someone who likes historical fiction or someone who particularly likes that area of history or that era of history. Or if you're looking for a writer of color, like here you go, there's one as well. Like Rani's just, I think she's brilliant. And I just think that her book does not get the love and attention that it deserves.
Okay, well, we'll also have to link, if you're listening to this or watching this, I will link the interview with the author of Savage Beasts that Erica recorded either in the show notes or in the description, wherever the text exists, where you're absorbing this information right now.
It's just me sobbing. It's me being like, I loved your book. It was so pretty.
Oh, well, now I have to go read it. I'm really excited. Oh, well, thank you so much for coming on and being my first guest after 2 years hiatus.
Literally anytime, Jean. I was like so thrilled to get the email. I was like, yes, absolutely. Anytime. You're a joy to talk to every single time. So
okay, well, you may be getting another email soon about the Iliad. Please do tweet us if you would like to. Oh gosh, do you even tweet anymore? X us? What?
I refuse to use that name. It's Twitter.
Just tweet. Let us know. Let us know if you'd like an Iliad dedicated special in which Erica can convince me it's a fantastic book.
If not, I'll cry. Just that everybody knows. If I don't get hit up with any of those tags, I'm just going to start crying and record myself doing that. And upload it. Don't worry. No pressure.
Oh, thank you so much.